wanted to kind of lay out where we're at. So we've been talking all about the person of David over the last 13 weeks. And this morning is kind of like the high point of David's life and ministry and work as a king. There's this great section in 2 Samuel, starting in chapter 7, that David is bringing peace, subduing the enemies around them. And chapter 7, 8, 9, and 10 are this great recount of all the good work that David is doing that he's supposed to be doing as a king, looking out for the best interests of the people that he was there to serve, rather than taking advantage of the people around him. And what we're going to find out is in the midst of this, in chapter 9, there's just this really short story. I think it's 11 verses long. And you are going to find out today, I think, what makes David so unique as a man and as a king. And this story, I think, exemplifies why we admire him so much. So it's a story that centers around his table and who eats with him. So we're going to kind of set this up this morning, and I need some volunteers. And there's food up here. And as you're a volunteer and you come up here, please, the food is for you to enjoy. That's why it's up here. So if you were lucky enough to come up, you know, if we're going to have a king's table's got to have some food on it. So go to it, have fun, eat some food. One of the things that you probably don't realize is we try and be as authentic as possible. You know, on Sunday we show you maps and stuff to really help you draw back into the original purposes of what's going on. Well, you may not realize this, but I actually found the drink that was at the king's table, and you can see it's in this aluminum holder. I'm not sure that they called it a Capri Sun, but this is grape juice. So we're trying to be as authentic as possible here. So Corbis can help me out with some of this stuff. So
it's not fermented grape juice, is it? No.
It's not fermented.
Okay, good.
But that's some of them might have had, but we're not using fermented grape juice.
Okay, and Noah uses the term voluntary kind of loosely here, since I'm going to walk around and pick some people to fill our spots at the table. Got 7 seats up there, so starting addressing the king in 1 Samuel 13:14. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and appointed him leader of his people. So we need a king.
We happen to have a really authentic crown here.
We have a crown here. Looks authentic.
Find me a good king.
Let's see, kings. So many worthy. So many worthy. Oh, Mr. Skelly back there, how would you like to come up and be our king today? All right, Chris. Thanks for volunteering. Take your seat at the table, my king.
Here you go, Majesty. Of course, make sure you sit at the head of the table up there.
Anybody out there looking for baby names? Joshua Bashebeth. Okay, he is a Tekemenite. He was the chief of the 3. He raised his spear against 800 men, whom he killed in 1 encounter. Okay, this is a unique position. Who is the spear wielder who can take out 800 men in 1 counter? I only know one person in the first 5 rows here. Papaginski. You're the spear holder.
Oh,
come on up here, buddy.
Careful, this thing's dangerous.
He throws spears with the best of them. Next to him was Eleazar, son of Dodai the Ahohite. As one of 3 mighty men, he was with David when they taunted the Philistines, gathered for battle. Then the men of Israel retreated, but he stood his ground and struck down the Philistines till his hand grew tired and froze to the sword. The Lord brought about a great victory that day, a sword yielder. Who is our sword yielder today? Who could strike down this many men till his hand would freeze to the sword? Volunteers. Mike, you're smiling over here. That's a dead giveaway. No eye contact, no smiles. That's the rule. Okay. Next seat, Benaiah, son of Jehoiada, was a valiant fighter from Kasbeel, who performed great exploits. He struck down two of Moab's best men. He also went down into a pit on a snowy day and killed a lion.
All of you know who, you know, you kill lions on a regular basis, know how snow complicates things when you're out killing lions.
Anybody here killed a lion? Sorry, on a snowy day? Leonard? Leonard, any lion killing lately? No, I think so. Come on up. Leonard, the lion killer.
I don't know if it'll fit on your head, but...
Very good. Seat number five, Joab. David had said, whoever leads the attack on the Jebusites will become commander-in-chief. Joab, son of Zeruiah, went up first, and so he received the command of the army. Who would this leader be standing out? Leaders, where are you? Oh, yes, he's texting. So, Randy, come on up.
Oh!
He's using his Bible, people. It's an iPhone Bible.
You weren't going to be a five-star general, but for texting in church, we're demoting you to a four-star general. Oh, yeah, yeah.
He was using his Bible,
that's,
right?
No, that's the classic.
King James.
I'm reading the Bible.
King James. I'm like, yes. The sixth spot is for our queen.
Oh, yes.
Proverbs 31:10 says, an excellent wife, who can find? She is far more precious than jewels. Chris, who is your queen?
Yeah, be careful right now, buddy. This could be big trouble for you. Oh, there you go. There
oh,
you go.
Your wife.
Where's Kelly? Come on up, Kelly.
Come on up here and join your husband, the king.
Kelly, you get a crown, and it's, you know, like normally there's a short, little elegant, but we gave you something a little more profound that my kids made during their medieval homeschool project this last year. So come on up, queen. All right. Outstanding. Thanks, Corbett. So every king in the ancient Middle East. Now stay up here. You guys aren't done yet, and you guys don't have long up here, so make sure you start eating because you're not going to have a long time. Now, every king in the ancient Middle East, they had a table, and they had certain people that they surrounded themselves with at this table. Now, as you can see up here at this table, we've got seven chairs, so there is one person missing. And one of the things that you are going to find out is the list of the names that we read. They're all people that were surrounded by David, that fought with David, that forged their relationship on the battlefield. They had this bond as men that worked together, that built the kingdom, that preserved the kingdom. And there's this whole list of you know, more than two dozen men that David accounts as his mighty men, of people that were men of honor and valor. And so you would understand that the king, when he sets up his table, who's he going to have around him? These are going to be some of the people that have, you might say, they've proven their worth, they've proven their valor. They're honorable people that have earned a spot at the table. Now, there's one spot missing up here at the chair, and I want to tell you about someone that David invites to come sit at his table. So, Corbett, go ahead and read for us.
Reading out of 2 Samuel chapter 9, David asked, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul whom I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake? Now, there was a servant of Saul's household named Ziba. They called him to appear before David, and the king said to him, are you Ziba? Your servant, he replied. The king asked, is there no one still left of the house of Saul whom I can show God's kindness? Ziba answered the king, there is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in both feet. Where is he? The king asked. Ziba answered, he is at the house of Machir, son of a meal in Lodabar. So King David had him brought from Lodabar, from the house of Machir, son of Amiel. When Mephibosheth, son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, came to David, he bowed down to pay honor to him. David said, "Mephibosheth, your servant," he replied. "Don't be afraid," David said to him, "for I will surely show you kindness for the sake of your father Jonathan. I will restore to you all the land that belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will always eat at my table."
Thanks, Corbin. All right, before you guys sit down up there, like I said, you don't have long, so eat up, man. One thing I'll tell you is, you know, normally we don't encourage eating at church, but if you want to take a couple grapes and some bread back with you, feel free to take it when you go here. Now, just a minute before you guys go, I'll whirl through each of these people up here. Yeah, Randy's like, "Got to get an order back there for my wife. What would she like from the table?" So each one of these people that we called up here, they sort of had, you could see that they had the right, the privilege. They had proven themselves worthy to be up there at the table. And we run into this guy that David brings into the picture named Mephibosheth. And Mephibosheth is interesting because he's done nothing to earn a place at the king's table. He hasn't done anything. And in fact, more than just having a seat at the table, notice what it says in there about him, that David treats him like one of his own sons. He sort of adopts him into his own family. Now, of all of the pictures in the Old Testament and all of the stories we have in the Old Testament, I think that, from in my opinion, this is the single best picture of what grace looks like that we have in the entire Old Testament. And so I want to walk through exactly what David does and why he does it and why this is so unique. All right, so guys, thanks for coming up. Grab your stuff. If you can leave your props here, because I'm going to need them again. Thanks. Besides, I don't want you to hurt anybody with that spear pad. Thank you. Your wife asked for a couple grapes. I like that. Good, good, good. All right, so we run into this guy named Mephibosheth, and I want to walk through just a little about who Mephibosheth was and why, what is so unique about who he was and what David does for him. So the first thing we find out is David is at the very beginning of the chapter, David asks this question: is there anybody left from the house, from the house of Jonathan that I can show? Now notice what he says here. He says that I can show kindness, God's kindness to. Now, in English, that word kindness is kind of a limp word. You might say, "Well, someone was really kind to me," or, you know, you might associate it with being nice. And we're going to find out in a minute that word kindness in the Hebrew means far more and has a far deeper meaning than just being nice to someone. And so Mephibosheth, interestingly enough, this person who used to be associated with Saul's family, and remember, Saul was the king before Jonathan. So Saul had this guy who worked for him named Ziba. And Ziba tells David, there is someone left from Jonathan's house that you can show God's kindness to. And he recommends this guy, Mephibosheth. Now, Mephibosheth was a son of Jonathan, and he seems to be the single last survivor from Saul's direct family or direct lineage. He is Saul's grandson. Now, why is he the only one left? Because in the ancient Near East, if you wanted to secure your kingdom, you would do your best to eliminate any opposition to it. And the first and foremost opposition that you would have would be from whoever was the king before you. Now, it's interesting in this case because David seems to be, to some degree, different than other kings, because David doesn't seem to actively participate in the knocking off of Saul's family. But you can read through these chapters before this, and David has surrogate people or people that want to earn David's favor that do that work. And so there is not anyone readily available. David asks this question because he doesn't know. He doesn't think there's anybody left from Jonathan's line. And if you go back to the story of David and Jonathan, what did we find out about them? That they were friends, and they were the best kind of friends. When we talk about what friendship really looks like, what does it mean to be invested in someone else's life in a way that says, it may cost me something dearly to be your friend, but I am willing to give that up to maintain this relationship. And that's what Jonathan in particular does for David. So David had this very unique relationship with Jonathan. Jonathan died with his father in battle. Nobody left. David still has this longing to do something good for someone from Saul's family and Jonathan's family. So Mephibosheth, we find out, is a son of Jonathan. Wow, well, why haven't we heard about this guy? Well, because he's crippled in both feet, which happens, if you read back in the beginning of 1 Samuel, you'll find out that some invaders come into his house where he was living, and the nurse goes to take Mephibosheth out of the house and escape. And in the process of doing that, Mephibosheth gets dropped, and that's how he ends up being crippled in both feet. So this guy is crippled. And one of the things that's interesting about that is if you were crippled, you were unable to serve as a priest or in any significant political capacity. So this guy had a couple things working against him. And when you had any kind of physical deficit back in their culture, that was a big, big black eye. So of Jonathan's family, he was kind of the least of Jonathan's sons. Now, this is the thing where we learn the most about who this guy is. Where did he go? And the place where he lived is this, in Hebrew, is called Lo Debar. And that word Lo means nowhere, no place. And the word Debar sort of means pasture or large agrarian area. And literally what the Hebrew is saying here is, you know what? This guy lived in the middle of nowhere. He was out in the middle of nowhere. In fact, if you go back and you look on maps, you won't find a place called Lo Debar. It is not a specific place mentioned on any map. It's a general area up east of the Jabbok River, kind of out in the middle of nowhere. So this guy, he's insignificant. He's small. He's not a part of anything important. He's hiding out and living out in the middle of nowhere. So David says, well, you know what? Here is someone. And notice what he does here. He doesn't go, well, is the person qualified? What has he done? How has he served? What has he done to prove that he deserves for me to show God's kindness to? Notice he doesn't ask any prerequisite questions. He just wants to show someone God's goodness. Doesn't matter how much they've done, what they've achieved, what he's going to bring to David's table. He just wants to do something good for somebody else. So David sends out for this guy, and can you imagine the fear this guy must have had when the soldiers or the messenger comes out and finds this guy? He knows he's heard who the new king is. And he knows what happens to everybody that's a part of the family of the previous king. Can you imagine what his first thought was? Whoa, they found me. This is probably not a good thing that I'm being summoned to Jerusalem, to the king's city. So he brings him in. And notice what David says right away to the guy. He says, Mephibosheth, do not fear. Well, why would he say that? Because this guy's freaked out. He's sure that this is going to be the end of his life. And David does gives him the very opposite of what he is expecting or thinking that his life is going to deserve. And so in this story, what we find out is David treats this guy with that word kindness. And this is sort of the motor that drives this whole passage, is this idea that David longs to show somebody God's kindness because of what he received from Jonathan. And so three different times in here, in this chapter, in this very short chapter, there's this idea of kindness. And like I said, that kindness is probably it's a mute word for what the Hebrew word really means, which is hesed. And it appears 248 times in the Old Testament. And it appears in lots of different forms, but in most of your translations, it's translated as kindness. Now, like I said, remember the last song that we sang this morning was Grace, Your Grace is Enough, and I told you we're going to be talking about grace, because this word sometimes is translated as grace. And Charles Swindoll has a great picture of what this is all about, what grace, when the Bible talks about grace, what does grace mean? And he says, we refer to a ballet dancer as having grace. We say grace at meals. We talk about the Queen of England bringing grace to events that she attends. Grace can mean coordination or movement. It can mean prayer. It can refer to dignity and elegance. Most importantly, grace can mean unmerited favor, extending special favor to someone who doesn't deserve it, who hasn't earned it, and cannot repay it. Do you see what is so different about Mephibosheth from everybody else that sits at that table? Everybody else sort of earns their right to be there. Mephibosheth has done nothing. In fact, the very opposite. Mephibosheth poses a huge threat because he is legitimately in the line of Saul. And if there is anybody who could say, I have a legitimate claim to the throne, Mephibosheth is the last guy around that can do that. And in spite of that, in spite of the fact that the guy has done nothing to earn a place with all these other guys that have earned a place at the table, David says, because of the grace that Jonathan showed me, I'm going to pass that along to the best of my ability. If anybody understood grace, it was David. He was the least of his family. When God came and chose him, who was he? He was the smallest boy. Nobody else in the family expected him to be the king. He's the guy who was sort of out in the middle of nowhere himself, watching the sheep when he was called in. David understands what it means to be graced. David understood what it meant to be treated with grace because of his relationship with Jonathan, and he longs to pass this on. Now, here's the thing that's so crazy. Imagine yourself, I mean, seriously, think about this. If you're sitting at this table and you're the guy with the spear, right? You're thinking, what's he doing here? Literally, you'd probably be thinking, what's the crippled guy who's done nothing, who poses a threat to your kingdom? What would you say to David after your first meal with Mephibosheth? You'd take your king aside and you'd go, have you lost your marbles? Are you nuts? Do you not realize the danger that's posed by bringing one of your biggest, probably your single biggest enemy, who's done nothing compared to the rest of us, who's shown no loyalty, hasn't proven himself at all, and you're giving him a place at the table? Now notice this. David doesn't just allow the guy to come eat with him, because that'd be one thing, wouldn't it? It'd be one thing just to say, hey, come eat with us. But he does more than that. What else does he do? He goes and he reclaims all of Saul's old land, some of the best land in the kingdom, and he gives it to Mephibosheth. And he allows Mephibosheth to do whatever he wants with that land. And more than that, David appoints Ziba and other servants to work the land, take care of the land, make sure the land produced monetary benefit for the guy. Now, this was more than even David had given to his own sons at this point. David literally not only adopts this guy and treats him as a son, he sort of treats him as the best of his sons to this point. So it wasn't just sort of like a nice dog and pony show, oh, I'll be nice to the poor guy who's crippled. It was way more than that. And everybody else around him must have been saying, are you crazy, guy? This is nuts. There's a sense in which when we stop and understand grace as unmerited favor, you didn't deserve it, you can't earn it, and you can't ever repay it, that when we see it done in this case, we go, are you nuts? And see, is that not, in a nutshell, what the Christian message is all about? Is that not what we get together here on Sundays and celebrate? When we recognize there was a king who adopted us as his children, and did you deserve it? Did you do something that God says, oh yeah, I'd like to have you on my team? No, in fact, the Bible tells us the opposite. The Bible tells us that we were in active rebellion against that God. I think you might think of it like this, that we were sort of out in the middle of nowhere. And God comes, and what does he do? He invites us to be his children. He gives us inheritance and invites us, what? To sit at his table as one of his children. And other people hear that story, and you hear it up here in a real sense, and you go, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Whoa. And that's when you realize how big, how profound, and how amazing grace is. And when you realize what God has done for us when He has given us His unmerited favor. Now, you could use the word kindness if you wanted to. But you understand why I think this is, you know, kindness is sort of a muted way for us to genuinely understand what this is all about. And I have no idea where my remote went. Oh, it's up here. So, just in closing, we're going to take communion in a couple of minutes here, because if we're going to talk about a table, how God invites us to a table, it would be wise for us to celebrate communion together. But I want to just close with three quick things here. The first one is, there's two observations that I have from this. The first one is this: what is it that genuinely makes Christianity unique? See, if you take all the different religions of the world, essentially, you know, the things that we look at about how we treat other people, what it means to be a good or a moral person, you know, almost every religion has significant agreement on those big things, particularly in terms of what it means to be a moral person. The significant thing that makes Christianity, though, so unique and makes it really stand apart genuinely from all other religions is this. It's about God's grace, and it's about how you came into relationship with Him. It wasn't because of anything you did. It's not because of anything you do. All other religions essentially say you can earn or curry favor with God via your morality, your actions, your service on His behalf. And you know what God says? Genuinely, that's not why I chose you. That has nothing to do with why God chose you. Hopefully, after you're chosen, you'll be motivated to serve and honor that king. But that has nothing to do with why He intrinsically loved you and called you to Himself. And that is so different than all other worldviews. It's so different than all other religions. It's really what sets Christianity apart, is that God chose you purely because of His grace and His favor, His unmerited favor in your life. The second observation I have in here is that there's a sense in which, so when we read the story, you can kind of go back to, like I said earlier, you can kind of go back and say, well, David experienced this grace in his own life. He intrinsically understood it because of what God had done for him, and also, and primarily, because of what Jonathan did in a very real way, his friend, how his friend treated him. And there's a sense in which I sort of think that in our own lives, I was talking with my wife this week, and we were talking about how good people in Tahoe have been to us since we moved up here. And we were recounting how many people have done amazing things for us, even just in this last week. And we were talking about it, and in that conversation, thinking about this passage, there's a sense in which I think that my wife and I, as people, have become more generous, more giving, more gracious in our own lives because we've experienced other people. We've had very real models in our own lives of other people treating us with grace. And so there's a sense in which I think that we're motivated to pass on that kind of treatment, gifting to other people because we've experienced it in our own lives. And I think that's something you can see really clearly here. And there isn't a person in here that shouldn't say, you know, you might struggle to think of how other people have been good to you. But you know what? There isn't a person in here that couldn't say, God. This is what the Bible says God did for you. This is why His Son died on the cross for you. Pour out His forgiveness for us. Not because you earned it. Not because you can pay Him back. Not because there's anything you can do to make up for what He did and the grace that He showed you. And when we really wrap our arms around what God did for us, regardless of what other people have done for us, there's a sense in which I think that ought to motivate us to go, wow, I understand why God calls me, expects me to live the way he does. Because if I'm going to live in relationship with this God, this is what he did for me, this is how I ought to live with other people. This is at the core, a big core of what it means to be a Christian, doesn't it? My grace, you've been saved. Right? Forgive as you have been forgiven. Right? God has this expectation that he says, you understand what it means to be gracious. Take some of what you've learned from me, how I designed you to live. Pass it on to other people. The reason this is such a challenge, I think, in America today is because we live in a retail-oriented society that says, I'll maintain a relationship with a retailer, someone who gives you a set of goods or services. And you say, I'll maintain a relationship with you as long as you continue to give me quality service or products at a reasonable price, right? That's sort of how we maintain our relationships with people that we buy things from. And what happens as soon as the price goes up or the quality of service drops, what do? We end up we sacrifice generally that relationship to go and get somebody else who will give us that product or that service at a better price. So in our retail, consumer-oriented America that we live in, we typically maintain a relationship with someone who gives us a good or a service as long as it meets my needs. As soon as it doesn't meet my needs, I'll go somewhere else to have my needs, my services met. The thing that is so different here, right, is that what you find in this relationship is it's not based on your needs being met. David doesn't invite Mephibosheth to his table because Mephibosheth is going to do any great thing for him. He doesn't know one way or the other. David, in fact, goes out of his way and gives up a lot. He sacrifices what? His own needs, his own personal interests, what other people may think of him, because people are going to think the guy's nuts for inviting Mephibosheth to his table. And David is willing to give up a substantial cost. And in fact, if you read on in this story, believe it or not, it will come back. It will come back to bite David that he shows this grace to Mephibosheth, and that's much later in the story. But it certainly does. It was a risky proposition, but in spite of that, David does this to maintain a relationship, and this is what we call a covenant relationship, where you're in a relationship with someone, not because they meet your needs. Why do I bring this up? Why do I bring up the whole retail thing? So much has been written in the last 20 years about how this is one of the biggest problems of our culture. We take our retail-oriented, our consumer-oriented idea of how to live our lives into our relationships. And the minute a relationship doesn't meet my needs, I will sacrifice that relationship to have somebody else meet it. And if you don't have any covenant relationships, man, that leaves us for a really empty society, doesn't it? If you don't have any relationships that are based not on meeting your needs, but based on God's loving kindness, sacrificing your own needs to bless and meet the needs of other people, we live in a pretty sorry world, wouldn't we? And a lot has been said, and I think it's not hard to look around and say, well, what are the biggest ills that we face in our culture? You know, people would say, well, there's economic stuff. Man, that's a drag on our lives. People would say, oh, the political stuff and all this bickering and arguing, that's a big drag on our lives. But I sort of feel like, the biggest issue that our culture faces today is this. Despite how our economy may be, despite who may be in power politically, I think that if we had healthy relationships, that would do more to make the world a better, more enjoyable, more easy to live in place than any other solution that we could have. And it's funny because God sort of says, here's what relationships are supposed to be like. Here's how we're supposed to make relationships work in our lives. This is why forgiveness is so important, right? This is why being generous and being gracious means so much to God. Because he recognizes that this is at the fundamental solution to the problems that we have in life and what we need. That's why he, first thing God did, the greatest thing he did to show us that he loved us, was give us his son Jesus to forgive us, to model, give us the very thing that we most need in our own lives to restore our relationship with God, was to forgive us. And there's this, he asks us to pass that along with other people. And I think that you can see, and this exemplifies what David does so well, is he does what nobody else would expect him to do. Nobody would have held David to that covenant relationship he had with Jonathan. Nobody would have, especially when it looked like being good to Mephibosheth. But David was going to do it because he knew that's the right thing to do, and that's how God called him to live, and that's how what he had experienced in his own life. I think the last thing I'd just ask you is this, is as you come up and take communion today, we're going to sing Amazing Grace. And I encourage you, you know, interact as they're singing Amazing Grace. I encourage you to sing Amazing Grace with them as you come up, recognizing that God's grace is amazing. But I think it's good for us just to ask ourselves this question. And I encourage you, as your families or with your friends this week, would you ask yourself that same question that David asked? Who can I show God's kindness to? So what we're going to do is have communion, and so what I'm going to ask you to do is get up from wherever you're sitting in just a minute here. I'll have you get up, and I'll have you go to the outside rows and come forward and take a cup and a cracker, and then walk back up here through the middle and return to your seats. And when we're done, after everybody's sitting down and we're done singing Amazing Grace, we'll eat and drink together. That's a neat thing about communion is there really was a king who invited us to sit at his table. And that's part of why we celebrate communion, thinking back to what Jesus did with his best friends the night that he was betrayed before he died on the cross, where he got down with them and he said, I'm going to show you the full extent of my love. And it was more than just washing their feet, but it was dying for their sins. And so he said, he laid out this really tangible way for people. For 2,000 years now, we've celebrated by remembering what he did. Jesus said, he took the loaf of bread and he broke it. And he said, this is my body. And whenever you gather together, do this in remembrance of me. So we have this cracker, and it's a reminder for us of Jesus' body and how it was broken for us. So let's eat it together. And like that, he took a cup and gave it to, he passed it around to each one of his friends. And he says, this wine, is remember this as my blood poured out for you. And so we drink this grape juice today as a reminder of Jesus' blood that was given for us for forgiveness of sins. Lord, thanks for making our faith something that's tangible and real. You know, this word kindness is more than just a definition of a Hebrew word, but it's lived out in the decisions and the choices that David made and how he treated other people. This is sort of the high point of David's whole kingdom, these chapters. And we're going to find out next week that David was a man just like the rest of us and needed forgiveness too. Lord, we all recognize in our own lives our great need for forgiveness. Likewise, Lord, we would ask that through these living models of what you have done for us, how David treated Mephibosheth, that help us, incline us to be gracious, live with covenant love with some of the people you placed in our lives. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thanks for coming.